This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his teaching on third semester New Testament Greek. This is session number 14, Clause Types.
One of the things that we are going to do as we work through Greek grammar is kind of build up from a lot of what we've been doing so far has been at the word level or kind of the word group level. So with, for example, with infinitives, we looked at a construction that had a preposition, article, infinitive. But when we talked about verbal aspect, when we talked about genitive case or accusative case, or when you talked about articles or pronouns, adjectives, adverbs, we're mainly focusing on individual units of grammar, dealing with grammar. And what we want to do is kind of move beyond just at the word level and start to talk in this lesson and the next, talk about grammar at the clause level and see how words are put together to form clauses, how those clauses function within the sentence. And then ending with even more broadly at a discourse level. How does grammar function at a discourse level in terms of looking at paragraphs and even larger units of discourse and seeing how grammar functions across that. So I want to talk to you a little bit about clauses and how what types of clauses there are, how they're put together, and how they function. And in this lesson, we'll focus on the couple of different types of clauses and then look at one of the more common types of clauses that you see in the New Testament is independent clauses or supporting, subordinate clauses, secondary clauses. There's different words for them. But there's a number of different types of those that you need to have a handle on to interpret the New Testament because they're so common. When we think of clauses, there are generally two types of clauses. You could argue that there's more than just these two, but these are the two most common and that you need to grasp in interpreting New Testament Greek. One of those is called the main or primary clause, and I'll use an arrow to illustrate it. This would be the main, or I'll call it the primary clause. These would be the clauses, if you ever had a grammar course that maybe simplistically said, these are clauses that can stand on their own, and they make sense. They communicate a thought or idea on their own. They can stand on their own. These are the clauses that move the discourse forward. And these are the clauses that communicate the primary ideas. They move the discourse along. Whereas another type of clause we could call secondary clauses, and that's illustrated by this arrow. And other words for those would be supporting clause or subordinate clause or something like that. And the idea of this is that notice the arrow points up to the primary clause. That is, these do not move the discourse forward, but instead they provide supporting, they provide descriptive, they provide secondary information. That doesn't mean it's not important. It just means the role that it plays in the discourse is not like the primary clause that moves the discourse forward, but instead, in a sense, you could say it slows it down in that it provides supporting, subordinate, explanatory information to the primary clauses in the discourse. And we've said, a typical clause could consist of, especially a primary clause, can consist of all of these elements. It doesn't have to in English or in Greek, but a kind of, we might say, a full-blown clause might contain all of these elements, a subject in the nominative case, a verb form. Most primary clauses will include a verb form in them, and could include a direct object, could include an indirect object. Again, in the Greek language, the direct object would normally be in the accusative case, though some verbs can take it in the dative or genitive case, and then the indirect object normally in the dative case. And then genitives can function to modify those elements showing possession or source or all those things we talked about in relationship to the genitive case. Secondary clauses will also generally have at least a verbal element in them. They'll have an indicative or a subjunctive. They'll have a finite verb in them that indicates person and number. That's what marks those out as a clause. But the key is, again, that the secondary clauses, again, to go back to some simplified approaches in some grammar classes you may have learned, these clauses cannot stand on their own. They require being dependent on. So you often hear the word dependent clauses. They depend on and they're connected to a primary clause. So these are the two major type of clauses, the main type of clauses in Greek. The primary clause, again, often called independent or main clause, those are the clauses that simply carry the discourse along. They move it forward. And then secondary clauses that do not move the discourse forward, but play a supporting role. They play a subordinating role. They're subordinate to or dependent on something in the main discourse or in the main clauses. Now, one of the things you'll find in Greek is this is sort of simplistic in a way, because what you'll often find is even secondary clauses can be modified by other secondary clauses. So sometimes you'll get what I call a stair step feature in Greek. You might have a main clause that gets modified by an independent clause, and that gets modified by an independent clause, and that could get modified by an independent clause. And that's why sometimes you find rather lengthy sentences in a really traditional English grammar class. You might call this a run-on sentence. That wasn't a problem in Greek. But in Greek, sometimes you'll find rather lengthy sentences. You find a good example. The classic example is Ephesians 1, 3 through 14, which is one long sentence or clause. And you might think, well, how do you do that? Well, there's only maybe one main clause, but it just keeps getting modified by subordinate clauses, and those subordinate clauses have subordinate clauses modifying them. And sometimes you can get rather lengthy expressions, and sometimes that's one of the keys to interpreting the text, is to sort that out. Where's the primary clause? And you should be doing this in any discourse, whether you're dealing with narrative or epistles or whatever, is asking where's the primary clause, or where are the primary clauses, and then where are the secondary and supporting clauses, and realizing that the primary clauses are those that, again, move the discourse forward, they carry it along, and the secondary or supporting or subordinate dependent clauses kind of slow it down and provide secondary supporting explanatory material to information in the primary clause. And then again, sometimes secondary clauses, they can have secondary clauses modifying them, so that you can get this kind of what I call stair step feature, where you just keep getting modifications. Some of Paul's letters are famous for that, and that's how you get rather lengthy sentences or lengthy clauses in the Greek New Testament. Now, what I want to discuss in a little bit more detail are the secondary clauses and the different types of secondary clauses that you find in the Greek New Testament that are important for interpretation, and kind of what What are the things that signal? You might wonder, well, how do I know what's the difference between a primary clause and a secondary clause? Well, the secondary clauses will have certain things that signal them and introduce them that make it clear that you're probably looking at a secondary or supporting clause and not a primary clause. And the next lecture will focus on a couple of secondary clauses more specifically, because they have some issues surrounding how and more details surrounding how we handle them, and that will be relative clauses and then conditional clauses. We'll discuss those in a little bit more detail. But I want to talk a little bit about what are some of the secondary clauses, how are they identified, and what different meanings do they convey? So when we think about secondary clauses, usually they function at the secondary clauses will function adverbially. They will generally modify the verb in the main clause or whatever clause they're modifying, and they will communicate an adverbial idea such as time and cause or manner or comparison or something like that. So for example, one type of clause is what is called a local clause. That would be, and again, we're discussing dependent or secondary, those modifying clauses that modify something else in the sentence. Local clauses, that would be clauses that indicate location, such as where something takes place. A common particle that introduces a local clause is the particle oo. Another one, I'm just giving some examples, would be pothen. And both of these indicate a location or where the action of the clause that they modified occurred. A really good example is Colossians 3:1, where it tells us, seek the things above. If you remember, we talked a little bit about this verse already, where the article was used to turn the adverb into a noun. So you have this zeteta, the imperative, the command to seek the things above. And actually, ta'ano, there's the adverb with an article, turning it into a noun. Seek, it functions as the direct object. Seek the things above. And then where, you have a clause introduced by this oo, where Christ is seated. Here it probably further modifies the ano, the things above, telling where the things above are. The things above, where Christ is seated. And the ooh indicates two things. Number one, it indicates that this is a secondary supporting clause. It's not the main clause. And second, it indicates location or a local clause. So local or location is one prominent type of secondary or supporting clause. Another one would be a result clause. And again, this would be another type of secondary supporting clause. It's often introduced by the conjunction hosta, so that. And again, the nice thing too is these will usually come first. They will head the clause. And in hosta, again, indicates, number one, that we're looking at a secondary supporting modifying clause, and number two, that indicates result in this case. So local clauses, result clauses. Another type of clause that's very common is a causal clause, a clause that indicates cause of action. The most common conjunction introducing that is hati. A hati clause. We're going to see hati can function in another way as well, but a hati clause can demonstrate cause. And again, it will come at the beginning of the clause that it introduces. And it introduces, number one, that this is a subordinate secondary clause. So whenever you see a hati clause, your mind should automatically say, here's a secondary clause. But second, it usually indicates the cause of the action of the clause that it's modifying. So cause, another one that's very common, another one that's common is, let me write out the adverbial meaning first. The other one is purpose, which is normally introduced by a hina clause. A hina clause. That is a clause beginning with the conjunction hina. So again, whenever you see a hina, you should think in your mind, here's a secondary supporting clause. That's one of the ways to identify that this is not the main clause, it's a supporting clause. And then when you see this, you should also think this is going to demonstrate usually purpose. Sometimes it could be result, but it's going to probably indicate the purpose of the action in the main clause or whatever clause it's modifying. So it will introduce a subordinate clause. Another type of clause to be aware of when we are talking about independent or supporting clauses is a comparative clause. A clause that indicates comparison. And a common conjunction to introduce it is kathos, just as. So again, this will be at the beginning of the clause. And it indicates two things. Again, this is, number one, this is a subordinate secondary clause. And number two, it's a clause that demonstrates comparison. And again, you can often translate it as or just as. Sometimes you'll just find the hosts, the conjunction particle hosts, indicating comparison as well. But a fairly common use of kathos and hosts, and fairly common use of independent clauses to show comparison. The last one I want to talk about probably is not technically a subordinate or secondary clause, but it's a clause that does not function as the main clause. We're going to see it actually functions as part of a clause or part of a main clause. You could actually call it an embedded clause. And that is what is known as a content clause. A content clause is basically a clause that will usually indicate the content of a verb, such as a verb of speaking or seeing or knowing, and it will indicate the content of what was said or what was known or what was seen. And two common conjunctions that can introduce a content clause. These aren't the only ones, but by far the most common one. One of them is a hati. Now, we've already seen that hati can introduce a causal clause, a clause indicating cause. Now, we're going to demonstrate it can also indicate a clause of content. So, when you think of hati, think of the two C's, cause and content. So everyone got that? The two C's, cause and content. Now, how do you know the difference? Well, it's probably going to be a content clause if it follows a verb dealing with perception, like seeing, speaking, confessing, knowing, believing. Those verbs don't have to take it, but they often will take their content in a clause introduced by hati. So that's why I said technically this will function similar to a direct object of a verb of perception. So again, that's what you're looking for. How do I know which of the two C's, cause or content? Well, you know, obviously context, but what in the context? One of the main things you're looking for is the verb of the main clause, is it a verb of perception? Again, seeing, knowing, hearing, believing, confessing, you know, verbs like that. And the hati very well could then demonstrate the content of that. Another conjunction that can introduce a content clause is hina. Okay, we've already seen it frequently, and probably more frequently, introduces a purpose clause, maybe sometimes even result. But occasionally, you'll find it introducing a content clause, a clause indicating the content. Again, this will be the case when it's followed by, you know, verbs of believing or seeing or speaking, things like that. Again, verbs of perception. An example of a content clause is found in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 9. And this is at the very beginning of Paul's letter, as he typically does. He'll begin with a thanksgiving or a prayer or something like that. And that's how Colossians 1:9 begins. So Colossians 1:9, Paul says, I do not cease. I do not cease, followed by two participles. I do not cease prosyukamai. I do not cease praying, prosyukamanoi, and asking. Aitoumenoi. Two participles. These two participles function as kind of giving the content of cease. I do not cease doing these two things, praying and asking. And then the next thing is a hina clause, in order that you might be filled. Pleirotheta. And I'll leave out the rest of the verse for now. But what I want you to notice is, notice this hina clause. So when I see that, the first thing I know is, here comes like a subordinate clause, a secondary clause probably. But I want you to notice, you know, when we ask, well, normally we indicate, you know, we interpret it to mean purpose. And that certainly would fit. I do not cease praying and asking in order that you might be filled. In other words, the purpose for Paul praying and asking is in order that his readers might be filled. And it goes on to say, with the knowledge of his will. However, is it possible that after two verbs of perception, that is, in this case, verbs of speaking, praying and asking, that the hina introduces a content clause? This is the content of what Paul prays for and asks. So, I do not cease praying and asking that you might be filled. That's the content of his prayer. So, either of those are possible. Another good example of a content clause introduced by hina is found in John. John has a number of these. John has a lot of hina clauses that function as in John's writings, both the gospel and also his letters, a number of examples of hina clauses that function to show content. Here's another one. This is in 1 John 2:27. And John says, I do not have need. I do not have need in order that, or tina, tis, in order that someone teach. henna. So is this demonstrating purpose? I do not have need in order that someone teach me. That's possible. The other possibility is this functions as a content clause, introducing a content clause, which further modifies need. It further describes the need. I do not have need. What is the need? The need is that anyone teaches you. So the point, though, is to be aware of, sometimes when I think of grammar, I kind of start with what is the, you know, statistically, what is the most likely usage of this? So when I see a henna, for example, I'm probably going to start with purpose. If I see a hati, I'm probably going to start with cause. But I'm also going to recognize that there are times where it may be, both of these may be used in a different way. And especially after verbs of perception, like speaking, a verb of perception doesn't work in the First John example. Something else is going on. But if there's a verb of perception, speaking, hearing, believing, knowing, those sorts of verbs, and I find a hati clause, and maybe even a henna, I might want to try out content. So those are examples of, again, we've talked about the two main types of clauses, primary clauses that are the main clauses that move the discourse along, and secondary clauses that don't move the discourse along, but they kind of stop it, and they serve to modify, provide modifying, explanatory, subordinating, supporting material. Then we looked at the different kinds of supporting, modifying clauses. That show, for example, temporal and causal and comparison and things like that, content clauses. So we've tried to move beyond just looking at individual words and now looking at the way entire clauses function. One other thing to say about clauses is some of these clauses, and I'll focus primarily on the last two types of clauses, or especially clauses introduced by hati and henna. But the same is true of other clauses. Hati and henna clauses tends to come after the verb they modify, after the clause they modify. When they come before, it tends to make that more prominent. Let me give you an example of this, just very briefly. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, this is Paul's spiritual gifts passage, where again we've looked at a couple things in chapter 13. And one of the things that Paul argues is by using the metaphor of a body, he's trying to demonstrate that all the gifts play an equal role and none of them are more important than the others, no matter how small or insignificant they seem. And in verse 16, notice Paul says, "And if the ear says, because I am not an eye, I am not from the body." Notice that the hati clause comes first. So you have Paul saying in 1 Corinthians, this is 13 and verse 16. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 16. It begins with the hati clause, because I am not an ear. Then the main clause, I am not. I am not of the body. And notice this reverses the normal order. The hati clause, normally the kind of the default orders for the hati clause to follow the clause that it modifies, the main clause. Here it's reversed. In all of these examples, then it goes on even before that in verse 15, because I am not a foot. Or if the foot says, because I am not a hand, I am not from the body. So verse 15 is another example of where the hati clause comes first. That probably draws more attention to the information in the hati clause. So again, just thinking in terms of even beyond just analyzing what the hati and hina clause is even word order or clause order can be important. A lot of these independent secondary clauses have a standard or a default order that when they're violated or when the author switches something around, for example, putting a hati clause or a hina clause first tends to foreground it more or make it more prominent. So we've moved again beyond individual words to clauses, and hopefully you've been able to see kind of how to approach clauses and the important role they play in Greek grammar.
This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his teaching on third semester New Testament Greek. This is session number 14, Clause Types.